Today we're going to study plagues 2 and 3. I tried to get in 2, 3, and 4, and it just didn't work out. Before we start, I just want to mention a word I've used a time or two. I've tried to write a definition of it up here. It's the word polemic. P-O-L-E-M-I-C. It's a word that you're going to hear me say over the next few weeks, and I just want to make sure you have a clear understanding of what it is. It's usually a written or verbal or sometimes graphic challenge to an opposing worldview. And in that challenge, many times elements of or vocabulary of that opposing worldview are used, a method of showing ridicule on that worldview. So many times they will take, in a polemical argument, you'll take imagery from the opposing view and give it new meaning in the argument that you're making. My contention is that the entire plague narratives of Exodus are polemical, that in every case there is an attack on the prevailing worldview that is the Egyptian culture. So when you hear me say today or next week polemic or polemical, I'm arguing that this is the way God has chosen to attack the opposing worldview of the Egyptians. Does that make sense to everyone?
Yes.
We spent a great deal of time laying the groundwork for the 10 plagues and pointing out that the plagues were directed at three elements of Egyptian society: the false gods of the Egyptian pantheon, the power structure represented by religious functionaries, the priests, the sorcerers, the magicians, the wise men, and third and last but not least, the king of Egypt himself, Pharaoh, who was viewed by the people as God on earth. And these are, in fact, where the emphases should be when considering the plague narratives, because it was in these three areas that power structure of Egypt was centralized. But if that's all we talk about when we study the plagues, we're going to miss something, because we need to consider what the reaction of the common man was in Egypt. What was the reaction of the commoner to these disasters that God brings to bear on Egypt? How was he affected? How would the man on the street have viewed the spoiling of the Nile River? What kind of people made up the citizenry of Egypt? Well, the Egyptians in the time of Moses are not the same as the Arab population that inhabits Egypt today. In the days of the ancient empire, the people were a light brown-skinned people. They were shorter than most of us. The average height of an Egyptian woman was 5 feet. The average height of an Egyptian man was 5'5". There are exceptions. Amenhotep II, who's the great-great-grandfather of King Tutankhamun, was 6 feet tall. But he was definitely an exception and an oddity among the Egyptian people. The Egyptians were musical. They had many different musical instruments at their disposal. They venerated their gods through songs and hymns and poems. They baked bread. They brewed beer. They built palaces, they built temples, they fought wars, they hunted, they fished, they mummified their dead, and they hoped for life after death. They lived in little villages along the east side of the Nile River. They kept animals, they farmed, carried on their lives in a manner that was the envy of other people in the Near East. Their little villages were typically walled. They had a single entrance, a single gate that served both as the entrance and the exit to the city. The streets were about 5 feet wide, just wide enough for a donkey to travel down there. They lived in mud brick houses. They were small. They usually had 4 rooms. They had flat roofs. There's no worry about snow or anything over there causing the roof to fall in, so they're flat. And many times the entire family, particularly during the hotter months, would go up on the roof and they would sleep up there as a family with the breeze coming off the Nile River. It just made the sleeping in a hot climate more tolerable. There were 3 social classes in Egypt. There was a lower class, of course, which made up the majority of the population. These were the farmers, the stone cutters, common laborers. There was a smaller middle class that consisted of scribes and priests, civil servants who worked in the Egyptian government. And of course, there were some who attained or were born into a higher class or an upper class, the king, the high priests, and a group known as nomarchs, who were provincial governors over these districts in Egypt, which were called nomes. In the south, there were 22 nomes, and in the north, there were 20. So there were 42 of these districts in the ancient empire of Egypt, and you can sort of think of those as states with a governor. The primary design of the plagues was as a polemic. They were a direct challenge to the three power centers of Egyptian culture, but the plagues also affected the common man, and we should bear that in mind when we're studying them. So last week, actually, we studied the first plague. Today we're going to look at plagues 2 and 3. The first plague is recorded for us in the 8th chapter of Exodus. Let's read that first plague. It'll be verses 1 through 15. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go to Pharaoh and say to him, 'Thus saith the Lord, let my people go that they may serve me.' But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite your whole territory with frogs. The Nile will swarm with frogs, which will come up and go into your house and into your bedroom, onto your bed, into the houses of your servants, and on your people, and into the ovens, and into your kneading bowls." This term swarm, I know some of your Bibles, I think the King James there says that the Nile will bring forth abundantly frogs. The actual term that's used there is the word swarm. And I'm going to be commenting on that a little bit later in the lesson. So just recall that the Hebrew word is the word for swarm in chapter 8, verse 3. And notice where these go. It says that the frogs will go into your house. Now, Pharaoh's being addressed there. So the upper class in Egypt will be affected by the plague. He'll go into your bedroom on your bed and into the houses of your servants. Now, that term servants is probably used in Exodus to refer to his counselors, his consultants, if you will. Think of it as the president's cabinet. These are probably not laborers. These are the middle class people who are bureaucrats in the Egyptian government. So the middle class is going to be affected by the plague. And then it says, and on to your people. The lower class will be affected. The entire nation of Israel, from the king down to the lowliest laborer in Egypt, will be affected by this plague. Verse 4. So the frogs will come up on you and your people and on all your servants. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Say to Aaron, stretch out your hand with your staff over the rivers and over the streams, over the pools, and make frogs come up on the land of Egypt." I want you to notice that this relationship that was established earlier between Moses and Aaron is still in effect. And notice that the thing to which he's to lift the rod, which is the way of symbolically striking Egypt, is once again over the rivers, the streams, and the pools. So even though the content of the plague is frogs, it's still the waters of Egypt which are being plagued in the second plague here. Verse 6, so Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt. The frogs came up and they covered the land of Egypt. The magicians did the same with their secret arts, making frogs come up on the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron. And he said, "Entreat or pray to the Lord that he remove frogs from me and from my people. And I'll let your people go that they may sacrifice to the Lord." Moses said to Pharaoh, "The honor is yours to tell me. When shall I entreat for you and for your servants and for your people that the frogs be destroyed from you and from your houses, that they may be left only in the Nile?" Then he said, "Tomorrow." I'll have a comment on that in a moment. So he said, "May it be according to your word, that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. The frogs will depart from you and your houses and your servants and your people. They'll be left only in the Nile." Then Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried unto the Lord concerning the frogs which he had inflicted upon Pharaoh. The Lord did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out of the houses, the courts, the fields. So they piled them up in heaps, and the land became foul. But when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord had said. We'll begin by considering the nature and the extent of these plagues. They're laid out for us in the first six verses. We don't really know how much time has elapsed between the first and the second plagues, but it seems reasonable to assume that the Nile River has recovered, that the first plague is over, and life has to some degree settled back into a normal routine. But at some point, Moses is again commanded by God to go before Pharaoh. The demand that he's to make will be the same: free Israel that they may worship Yahweh. The consequence of disobedience will be a second plague, and the nature of it will be a nationwide infestation of frogs. All right, let me ask you a question. I'm asking here mainly of the ladies. How many of you like frogs? Anyone? We have two little girls back here who like frogs. And we have one adult female who raised her hand, but to protect her identity, I'll not mention her name. My wife hates frogs. Now, I really wish at some time in this class, each one of you could stand up here and see Linda's face when I begin a sentence with the words, "my wife." I never tell her when I'm going to talk about her, so she's sitting there thinking, what in the world is he going to say about me? Well, here's what I'm going to say. My wife hates frogs. She comes by this quite naturally. In her neighborhood in Oklahoma City, there were some girls that she played with, and typically she did so without incident. But there also were some boys. And there's just something about boys and frogs. I don't know what it is, but every guy in here is smiling. I know you know what I'm talking about. There's also something about boys and frogs and girls who hate frogs. Without going into too many details here, one day some boys caught enough frogs to fill a gallon jug with frogs stuffed in there. There was a scuffle that ensued, we'll say, on Linda's front porch, in which the jar was dropped, and suddenly my wife was surrounded by what seemed to be 1,000 jumping and croaking frogs. Now, I'm not going to go on for fear of inducing nightmares, but I think you get the picture. I didn't grow up in the city. I grew up in the country. Now, I'm going to take just a minute, and I'm going to show you some pictures. And before I show you these pictures, I want you to understand something. These pictures have nothing to do with frogs. They have nothing to do with Egypt. They actually have nothing whatsoever to do with our lesson. I just don't want you sitting there thinking, does he realize that these pictures have absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about? Yes, I know that. I actually felt a little bit weird about this until I went to the church service this morning, and Chris started out the service by showing pictures of his dog. I relaxed after I saw that. This is Big Canyon, Oklahoma. This is where I grew up. The river looks a lot like the Nile River must have looked after Moses got finished with it after the first plague. This plant that you see here, it's where my dad worked. You see, we lived at a limestone rock quarry, actually on the back side of it. It was a great place for a boy to grow up. Our house was located at the foot of this mountain about 100 yards up from the river. This mountain was my home away from home almost every day that I wasn't in school. I'd like to have a nickel for every time I've climbed the mountain. This is where we lived. Actually, our house sat on this foundation. If you look real closely here, this is my old basketball goal. Still there. That was my backyard. Now, isn't that prettier than North Texas? I know this has nothing to do with Egypt, but it kind of does. I'm hoping it does. You see, what I remember when I think back on my childhood are summer evenings when we would sit outside and we would just enjoy the beauty of the land around us, and we particularly enjoyed the sounds of summer. If we were not at Big Canyon, we were about 18 miles north of there in a little town called Sulphur, Oklahoma, where my grandparents lived. And more than likely, I was chasing lightning bugs and maybe catching a frog or two. What I remember about those days are the summer sound of what we called June bugs. You know what those are? Whatever the stress of the day must have been for the adults, sounds of summer were peaceful. It was something we loved to do. Sit, swing, visit. On some occasions, make a freezer of homemade ice cream. And just enjoy the sounds of summer together as a family. And I think in this, we're not that different from the Egyptians. During the months of July through September, when the Nile would rise up and to its flood stage, the people of Egypt couldn't work. The water would fill these reservoirs and canals and ponds that the Egyptians had dug. And when the waters would recede, the waters would remain in the ponds and the canals and the reservoirs, and they would use that water later in the year to irrigate their fields. When the waters receded, the ponds, the canals, and the reservoirs remained filled, and they formed a perfect habitat for, guess what? Frogs. That's right. Frogs were as much a part of life in Egypt as June bugs were to summers in Oklahoma. And in fact, this may surprise you, the Egyptians loved frogs. I suspect that on evenings when the fields were still flooded, the people weren't working, families must have gathered up on the flat roofs of their houses and they must have listened to the distant sound of frogs, much like we listen to the June bugs in Oklahoma. To an Egyptian ear, particularly to the common man, it was a pleasant sound. It was pleasant because it meant that Hapi, the god of the Nile River, had done what he was supposed to do. The river's flooded, it's deposited fertile silt and water on the fields. The farmlands are going to be fertile. There'll be crops, there'll be food for the coming year. And the distant sound of frogs in Egypt meant that life would go on and families would prosper. The Egyptians liked frogs because they were an indication of good things, fertile fields, and the continuation of life. In fact, we know this because archaeologists have dug up a number of amulets that are in the form of frogs, and they were worn by Egyptian women who, unlike most of you, apparently liked frogs. And I'm sure you will not be surprised when I tell you that there is an Egyptian goddess depicted with the body of a woman and the head of a frog. Her name is Heket, spelled H-E-Q-E-T. She was associated with fruitfulness, with blessing, and with the assurance of harvest. Last week, I talked a little bit about a god named Khnum. I told you that he was associated with the Nile River, particularly in the role as the overlord of the two sources. There are two sources to the Nile River. There's the White Nile, which comes out of Central Africa with headwaters in Rwanda. And then there's the Blue Nile, which gets most of its waters from the mountains in Ethiopia. And they come together in Sudan, and they form what we call the Nile River. Khnum's role was to oversee those two sources. And many times he's depicted pouring water out of a beaker, and that water then becomes the Nile River. He is known as the ram head god. You can notice his head here is the head of a ram. He had another role in Egyptian mythology. He was said to be the god who created the earliest men and some of the earliest gods, and he did so on a potter's wheel. Before him, kneeling, is Hecate. See the frog head? Standing on the potter's wheel is the Pharaoh. We know this is the Pharaoh because he wears the Nemus crown and he has on his head the Urias, or the reared cobra. When Khnum would form a man, in this case the Pharaoh, on the potter's wheel, in Egyptian thought, Hecate had a role to play. She is, by the way, his consort or wife. When Khnum formed the man or the god, Hecate would then breathe into his nostrils life. Here you see Hecate holding two symbols. I've tried to draw this here. This is called the Ankh sign. This hieroglyphic letter is pronounced Ankh, and it means life. So when you see this particular sign, and notice she holds an Ankh sign in this hand, and here she is issuing forth an Ankh sign to the Pharaoh. She's fulfilling her role as the one who gives life to the one that Khnum has created. To the common man in Egypt, when he thought of this goddess Hecate, he thought of her as the symbol of resurrection and the emblem of fertility. Here's another depiction of her. Because of Hecate, frogs in Egypt were considered sacred animals. You could not kill a frog in Egypt. There are occasions where someone has accidentally killed a frog in Egypt and went to the execution block for it. So what's the point of the plague if Egyptians loved frogs? Well, it's this. The frogs came out of the river in abundance, and they moved across the land. They came into bedchambers, beds, ovens, kneading troughs. This is where the Egyptian women are trying to make bread and cook for their families. According to verse 3, the people were not able to keep the frogs off of themselves or their children. The phrase there that's used in verse 3, shall come upon you, can be translated, will climb upon you. When you rose in the morning, frogs. When you cooked your food, frogs. When you sat down to eat, frogs. When you climbed into bed at night, frogs. When you got up at night, you stepped on frogs. Can you imagine how husbands felt after about a week of their wives complaining about frogs everywhere? See, the issue here is not frogs. The issue is a matter of scale. It's the number of frogs. And I envision this plague coming about over a 2 or 3 day period where they just move in mass into these little villages and more or less take over. Well, what does Pharaoh do when this happens? We're told in verses 7 through 15, he falls back on the old game plan. He calls the sorcerers of Egypt. They come out. He has them duplicate the plague with a counterfeit miracle. I have two comments about this. First, the sorcerers were, in this case, indeed able to duplicate the miracle, just as they did with the first plague. But they weren't able to do what would have been preferable, and that is to reverse the plague. In fact, if you look at the reverse, if you look at the conclusions of when the sorcerers get involved in this, their serpents were swallowed by Moses' serpent. They managed to turn water to blood, but that only resulted in less clean water, not a reversal of God's judgment. And here they bring more frogs on the people, not fewer. When we get to verse 8, it almost looks like Pharaoh's theological perspective is improving. It reads, then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron. Apparently he's finished with the sorcerers at this point. He calls for Moses and Aaron and he says, entreat the Lord that he remove the frogs from me, from my people, and I'll let the people go that they may sacrifice unto the Lord. Seems like he's getting the message, but truthfully, I don't think anything has improved. I don't think anything at all has changed with Pharaoh. He's making some noises that sound a little better than the ones he made back in chapter 5. I notice here that he doesn't call again for his sorcerers. He calls for Moses and Aaron. He asks them to pray for him, and he even uses the divine name Yahweh. You may remember back a few chapters, he's the one who said, "Who is Yahweh that I should obey him? I don't know anyone named Yahweh." Well, he's beginning to learn. I want you to recall that behind all that happens in the plague narratives, there's a divine purpose, which was stated back in the last chapter, verse 5, that the Egyptians will know that I'm Yahweh when I stretch out my hand against Egypt. Pharaoh is coming to know who Yahweh is, but unfortunately, it will not be Yahweh's mercy or his covenant love that he comes to know. Pharaoh will come to know his wrath and the arm of his judgment. Even this empty promise he makes to release the Israelites is going to turn into a lie. So nothing's changed in the heart of Pharaoh. He's still hard-hearted. He's still anti-God in every way. Then we come to verse 9. This is a difficult verse to translate. Now remember here, the question is, when shall I pray for you so that the frogs will leave? The King James translates this, "Glory over me, when shall I entreat for thee?" The NIV reads, "I leave the honor of setting the time for me to pray for you to you." The NASB simply says, "The honor is yours to tell me." Whenever you see such a great divergence in English translations, you can be certain that the Hebrew text is difficult to translate. A literal translation is this, "Glorify yourself over me." It's an idiom. It is a way of saying, "I grant to you, Pharaoh, the privilege of choosing when I should pray for you." Now, it probably strikes you as odd if you read an English translation here that it appears that what Pharaoh says is, in response to the question, "When shall I pray for you so that the frogs go away?" It seems a bit odd that he says something to the effect of, "Oh, anytime tomorrow will be fine." Doesn't that seem a little strange? Why wouldn't he say, "Immediately"? The fact is, literally what he says is, "Against tomorrow." That's the literal Hebrew translation. "When shall I do this?" "Against tomorrow." Well, what is against tomorrow? Today. This is a way in Hebrew of saying right now. So he's not saying, "Oh, anytime tomorrow will be fine." The plague is serious, and he's saying, "Get rid of these frogs right now." The significance of this dialogue is to draw attention to the timing. So draw attention to the fact that Yahweh is in control of Egypt's destiny, both regard to when a plague begins and when a plague ends. What is miraculous in this plague lies beyond the content of the plague, because frogs were already in Egypt. They were common. It's the timing. It's when the plague begins. It's when the plague ends. It's the ones toward whom it's directed. It's in those who are excluded. It's in the inability of any power in Egypt, short of the power of repentance, to reverse the plague. That's the miraculous and supernatural element that's in play here. Verses 12 and 13. Moses is a man of his word. He prays to the Lord, and the Lord did according to the word of Moses. When you see in verse 11 the mention that the frogs will remain in the river only, it's a pretty good indication that the Nile has now recovered from the first plague and that the waters are no longer polluted. We're also going to learn here in verse 15 that the reason we can be sure that Pharaoh's apparent theological improvement was false is we read, "When there was relief, then Pharaoh hardened his heart and he did not obey." It's a human tendency. We tend to turn to the Lord when difficult times are upon us. And then when good times come, we just don't have that same sense of need. He finds relief, and he turns to disobedience. He's the same Pharaoh. He's the enemy of Israel. He's the enemy of Israel's God. So, if we want to sum up the theological intent behind this second plague, The force of the polemic is directed toward the Egyptian fertility goddess Hecate, who is formerly seen as a blessing, but it's now become a curse because of this infestation of frogs. The underlying purpose of the plague is retaliation for the Egyptians' attempt to eradicate the Hebrew males in Exodus 1 at the Nile River. The frogs came directly out of the Nile River. It's the place where the transgression occurred, and it is still the source of the second plague. In fact, it's the source of the first two plagues. And that's a fitting retribution against Pharaoh for attempting to use the river as an execution chamber against the Hebrew infants. Once again, the message here is that Yahweh is more powerful than the gods of Egypt. Well, we come to verse 16. That begins the account of the third plague. I'm going to read here verses 16 through 19. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Say to Aaron, stretch out your staff and strike the dust of the earth." The earth here should probably be translated land. The word eretz can be translated either land or earth. And here we're talking about Egypt. So let's translate it that way. "Stretch out your staff and strike the dust of Egypt, that it may become gnats through all the land of Egypt." And they did so. And Aaron stretched out his hand with his staff and struck the dust of the land. And there were gnats on man and beast. All the dust of the land became gnats through all the land of Egypt. The magicians tried with their secret arts to bring forth gnats, but they couldn't do it. So there were gnats on man and gnats on beast. Then the magicians said to Pharaoh, "This is the finger of God." But Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them as the Lord had said. There's one thing that Egypt has a lot of, it's dust. So that was a very good little analogy here of showing you the extent of this third plague. The extent of it is given in the first two verses we read, 16 and 17. One thing that's different with this plague is that it came on Egypt without any warning. The other two plagues were preceded by a warning. In this case, at the command of the Lord, Moses stretches forth his rod against the dust, and God transforms the dust into something that the Hebrew text calls kenim. Probably means gnats. There have been some people who argued that they were mosquitoes, but about the bulk of the evidence seems to make these simply as gnats. The text tells us that they were on both man and on beast. Here the term man is used in contrast to beast. It's a figure of speech here. It's called a merism, on man and on beast. What a merism means is when you take two extremes, you mention those two extremes, but what you really mean is everything. So when we read in Genesis 1 that God created the heavens and the earth, what that really says is he created the universe, the heavens, the earth, and everything in between. When God sets our sins as far from himself as the east is from the west, that's a merism. It means that he has eradicated completely our sin. But there's something that really goes beyond this, and that is the contrast that we see in this sentence between man and beast. And I want to point out that nowhere in the Bible is man classified as an animal. That does not mean that we don't have certain similarities with the animal kingdom. We share the similarity of biological life, but with a stark dissimilarity. That being that we were created in the image of God and therefore are bearers of that image. And that's what distinguishes man from animals. John Davis wrote a book called Moses and the Gods of Egypt. It's actually a very good book. And he points out that unlike in the first and second plagues, it's not really clear against what deity or deities the third plague was directed. In other words, he's sort of questioning whether this has a polemical force to it or not. Well, he's correct if in order to find the polemical element of the third plague, we have to find an Egyptian god or goddess who's depicted as a gnat. But it may very well be that Davis is looking in the wrong place for the wrong creature. Maybe there's another way to interpret this plague. The Hebrew word for beast is behemoth. It's a general term, but it includes, and it's many times translated as cattle. In the Egyptian pantheon, there was a bull deity known as the Apis bull. Here's a picture of an Apis bull. In order to be an Apis bull, it had to be a bull that was black and white, and it had to have certain markings on it. If you look here, this sort of depicts how they viewed the what they call the Apis sign. See this circle up here? That's the sun disk. And you see also the cobra. Back to this bull for a moment. Here's the Ankh sign. Here's the Apis sign. This is how they viewed the bull. The bull had to have certain markings, and one of the markings it had to have was on its forehead. It had to have a white triangle. The white triangle is represented here. These represent the bull's horns. This represents the sun disk, just as you see here, except you're looking at the bull head on. Notice the similarity between the Apis sign and the Ankh sign. They believed when they saw this particular bull with the particular markings that it was related. And you can see why they said that. An Apis bull was allowed to live 25 years. If the bull did not die within 25 years of natural causes, at the end of the 25th year, it was drowned in the Nile River by the priest, and it was embalmed. At Saqqara, Saqqara is the cemetery or necropolis for the city of Memphis. Remember, I told you people lived and worshipped and did their life on the east side of the Nile because that's the side where the sun rises, and they associated that with life. They built their pyramids and their tombs on the west side of the Nile where the sun sets because they associated that with death. They farmed, by the way, on both sides. So you have Memphis, which was the ancient capital of Egypt. It's about 20 miles south of current-day Cairo. Then over on the west side, you have Saqqara, which was the cemetery for Memphis. That's where the Step Pyramid is and other burial grounds over there. It's a burial place for Apis bulls. This is a sarcophagus for a mummified Apis bull. We know of 67 Apis bulls. I assure you there were others. But there are many of these buried just across the Nile River from Memphis in these giant sarcophagi. How many of you like gnats? Well, it's not a good day for the SPCA, is it? You don't like frogs, you don't like gnats. I can't stand gnats. But it may not be in the irritation brought about on the Egyptian people by the gnats that solves the mystery of the third plague. The mystery may be solved by focusing on the irritation of the gnats on the bulls. A bull is a large animal. In Egypt, the Apis bull was considered a divine creature. But all bulls were sacred, not unlike in India. Perhaps we find the polemic not in a god depicted as a gnat, but in the sacred bull that, though large and revered and even considered a god, could not defend himself against something as small as a gnat if that gnat was sent against him by the hand of Yahweh. That, I believe, is the polemical element of the third plague. How did the sorcerers respond? Well, we learned in 18 and 19 that, as previously, they came forward expecting to duplicate the miracle. It appears that they expected that they would be able to produce a counterfeit miracle, but they failed. And it's just as well, because you know what would have happened. They would have brought more gnats on the people. They would have compounded the problem, which was almost insurmountable to begin with. And they finally gave up and they said, "This is the finger of God." This could just as easily be translated, "This is the finger of the gods." I don't think it indicates that they're putting their faith in Yahweh at this point. It does indicate that they've called it quits and From a theological point of view, it appears that Yahweh has had enough of the satanic counterfeiting, and he's pulled the plug on Lucifer and his sorcerers. So as the account ends, gnats are on man, gnats are on beast, and Pharaoh once again turns to disobedience. How do we conclude this? Well, the common man in Egypt, the Egyptian citizen, bore the brunt of these plagues. They weren't necessarily directed at him, but it was he who had to dig for water when the Nile was polluted during the first plague. The frogs were in his house. They were in his bed. His wife had to contend with frogs in the kneading trough and gnats in the food. The gnats plagued his livestock. Eventually, even a king as powerful as Pharaoh can't stay in power if the citizenry is unhappy. Now, there's an interesting twist just beneath the surface of these plagues, and also beneath the surface of the plagues to come. And it's this: God is reversing the blessings he bestowed on mankind in creation. He's turning the broken world of the Egyptians upside down. When God uses animals against humans, it's a reversal of a pattern that he established in early Genesis in the creation. Here, animals become the instrument of justice for God. The ideal pattern was set forth in Genesis, that man was to have dominion over the earth and over the animals, Genesis 1:28. But this is a chaotic depiction of animal behavior. Here in plagues 2 and 3, and we'll see also in plagues 4 and 8, it shows God releasing an anti-creation force against the Egyptians. Animals are dominating men. It's backwards. It's inverted. In fact, the use of the Hebrew term sharats, which is the word that's translated to swarm, that I pointed out in verse 3, is a creation word. In Genesis 1:20, God said, "Let the waters swarm with swarming creatures." And there it was a good thing because it was a perfect world and it showed the multifaceted creativity of our Lord. But in Exodus 8, this chaotic teeming or swarming is a destructive abundance of what was a good thing in moderation. And we've already seen in chapter 1 that Pharaoh was portrayed there as an anti-creation force when he tried to oppose the cultural mandate that God had given to man. God said in the creation, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." Pharaoh tried to prevent Israel's obedience to the cultural mandate through hard labor and eventually through outright murder. But God overthrew his efforts through godly midwives, and by saving Moses from the river by the very hand of the daughter of the Pharaoh who had condemned him. In Scripture, there is always a strong relationship between creation and salvation. Regeneration itself is a recreation of the human spirit that was lost in the fall. But you see, God's plan for Egypt is not regeneration, it's judgment. His instrument of justice is the reversal of the principles that he laid out in Genesis 1. We're only beginning to see this. We've talked about the first triad of plagues, the first three. We're going to continue to see how this plays out over the course of the rest of the plagues. So in closing today, I want to focus on just a spiritual truth or two that is apparent in the verses we've looked at today. The first is this: self-will, pride, and arrogance are contrary to the divine ordering of the world. In the personal sphere, when we act in pride and arrogance and self-centeredness, then in the physical sphere, we can expect discipline from the Lord. We see this in Exodus as the story traces Pharaoh's pride and his arrogance all the way to the death of his firstborn and eventually the destruction of his army in the Red Sea. And second, sin always leads to problems in the physical realm. There's no escaping the consequences of sin. And we see this with Pharaoh. Sin finds its clearest expression in physical death, for it's appointed unto man once to die. And if a person dies without accepting Christ, then he must also experience the second death, which is defined in Romans 21 as the lake of fire. The story of the plagues is more than an account of the misfortunes of an Egyptian king and his subjects. It's a story of sin and judgment, and it's a story of faith and redemption. And we would do well to heed its lessons. Any questions this morning?